one of the common themes we've heard from our fan base this year is that even though the team is not winning as many games as ultimately we want to be winning, and we expect to be winning within the next few years, but it's exciting baseball. You know, it's a young group of players that are working really hard, that are giving everything that they have, and it's exciting.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a
Rockets.
I would buy you a
Rockets.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
buy you
rocket fuel for your rockets.
Maybe an
one-way ticket for Ian Kinsler to Alpha Centauri.
And if I had $1 million.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Gwintelligence Podcast. I am David Marver of Change the Padres, joined with Padres Jagoff, a.k.a. H.J. Preller.
Marver, two episodes in a row for leisure with you in person. This is very exciting for our listeners.
Yeah. I mean, we're not in person. We're recording separately.
No, you've made it incredibly difficult to meet you in person.
Well, you know, when you play as much basketball as me, you know, your schedule just gets really convoluted. I just don't have the time. But, yeah, hopefully more in person soon.
Well, yeah, you're very much in demand. I mean, I'm sure your post game is second to none.
I don't have a post game, although I did have a hook shot today from about 6 feet, I would say, on a putback. It was kind of nice. But yeah, I don't really tend to post up. That's just not what I go to.
Well, you don't have the size. I mean, if we're being honest here, I mean,
definitely don't. Well, I mean, it depends. Sometimes I get matched up with a really small guy, and it's like, okay, I should post up here. Like, there's no reason I shouldn't. I've got 4 inches and 40 pounds on him, but it's just not really my game. It clogs the lane. I think spacing is the biggest and most important thing in basketball. That's why you don't really see post players being all that important anymore in the NBA. And also in, like, pickup games, it's ones and twos, and that just makes the two-pointer so valuable that I actually always hate having someone on my team who has to go post. Like, that's just the worst, I think.
I'm actually, yeah. You cut me off. I had a great joke when you said, you mentioned 4 inches. I was going to say 4 inches is right. I think that would have been great. But you killed the clock. That was very...
Oh, my bad.
It was very Fowler and Partello-esque of you. It's great.
Yeah, so hey, you know, earlier this week, I think 2 days ago now, or is it yesterday? It was yesterday. You know, I woke up and I thought, you know, this is it. I've peaked. My Fran Mill bit, this is the peak of my existence. I'll never have a bit as good as the Fran Mill bit. Like, this is it, you know? Like, it just flashed so fast. but then Cody Decker apparently name searches his tweets and decided to respond to a tweet which was like 3 days old, something like that. So not quite in old senile Ted Leitner area, but, you know, still pretty out there as far as behavior goes. And what ensued was, I'm sure, a lot of entertainment for everyone.
It is important to note that he was not added in the conversation at all.
He was not. Yeah, and sometimes I do it purposely, and sometimes there's just no reason to add him. Right, but...
Well, you made a real enemy, Marver. I mean, were you planning on creating an enemy of a Padres all-time great like Cody Decker?
No, I mean, that's the thing. So, you know, full disclosure, I actually have had him on mute for, I mean, at least a year. I would say maybe 2 or 3 years. I remember the day I muted him in Delaware. And just as a note, like, I don't block people on Twitter, but I have, like, well, you know, well over 100 people muted. And most of the time it's for, like, just retweeting way too much political stuff, or, like, you know, if you retweet, like, I don't know, 80 things by the Baltimore Ravens or just something super random that I just have no interest in ever seeing and it's just too frequent, I will mute you. And so he was actually muted. And so when I was getting, you know, blown up by Leisure and everyone else who had seen his tweet well before I actually didn't know what was going on. I had to click through, and, you know, sometimes it doesn't let you scroll up to see what the thing was, and I didn't know. So finally I got someone to send me a screenshot, and then I went and unmuted Cody Decker, and I was able to scroll up and see everything. Definitely was not trying to make an enemy, but, you know, you get what you really get what you earn with me, right? And the way he responded was just so crazy. I mean, for those of you who didn't see it, basically, Cody Decker did an interview on the Ben and Woods show. And he made a point on the show, you know, a couple points, I think, that were part of this Twitter thread where we were disputing some of the things that were said on the air, particularly about payroll. But But one of the points that Cody Decker made was that AJ should be judged more critically for his international signings. And I just disagree with this point, number one. The main reason I disagree with this point is that, you know, I think the main thing we all care about is the outcome. And everyone knows international free agents are, you know, can be a bit more expensive and more volatile, but it's a risk that's worth taking. And if you start over-emphasizing, you know, those signings, you're basically disincentivizing your GM from taking more volatile, expensive risks, which I do not want to disincentivize. So I'm not, I don't think it makes too much sense, to be honest with you. It's a little arbitrary. But I also thought it was kind of weird for a guy who essentially got cut by the Padres and AJ Preller to be making this sort of statement about other Padres prospects as if he's a completely impartial bystander, right?
Well,
and, yeah.
Here's the thing. That thread that started, that led to this blow up, was kind of started by me, because I questioned something, and I blind quoted. I didn't at anyone. I just took a quote off the radio show, and Ben Higgins jumped in, and I think that he thought that I was arguing against something Cody Decker had said, and that's the way the thread progressed. And the quote that I pulled was, quote, "We say the Padres are still below average payroll, but you, referring to the fans, are not factoring in what it cost to acquire Tatis years ago. That's not part of it. But really, it is. It is part of it." And so I called out that quote as being ridiculous, because as I've written about and you've talked about and we've all talked about plenty of times, like, that money's been accounted for plenty. You know, that took the place of Major League salary. And so I called out that quote, and Ben Higgins responded as if I was arguing with Cody. And I just didn't – I didn't care. To be honest, I don't care what Cody Decker thinks about it. He's a podcaster on radio.com. It's like not the number one priority for me. So I dropped it.
It's also a Mike D subsidiary, I believe.
Of course. Mike D is actually the one who is pushing the radio.com sports subsidiary very hard.
Yeah.
And so that thread, for whatever reason, got resurrected when Cody decided to – name search himself, which led to this incredible day on Twitter yesterday, all based on a misunderstanding.
I mean, I just love how it's you know, his major point here was that he wasn't actually cut by the Padres, and I guess, you know, there isn't really even a technical cutting in Major League Baseball. If the Padres, quote, cut someone, the real term for it is designated for assignment. So if you're going to argue, you know, semantics about getting cut, you can pretty much always argue that in baseball.
Please don't argue semantics.
No, it's just so stupid, because, I mean, at the end of the year, he wasn't added to the 25-man, which means that the Padres essentially abused him for as long as they could, exhausted all of his years of control as a minor league player before he became a minor league free agent, and, of course, then left. So, I mean, it's totally semantics as to whether or not you want to call that getting cut. It sounds to me, and, you know, part of the discussion that he had with me was saying how, you know, how much of a loser I am. My career probably didn't go anywhere, blah, 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 which, you know, I came to terms with that when I was 16. This is a man who's twice that age now, still hasn't come to terms with it, and kept coming back with stuff that was just so easy to shove in his face. It was really, I was actually in tears laughing for some of them that I came back with.
What about when he totally pwned you by calling you a schizophrenic yelling at pigeons? That's good writing.
Yeah, that one really got me. In fact, actually today I went back through and I went through all of his tweets to me, and I wanted to see, you know, how many of them actually, you know, wounded me emotionally. And it turns out he went 0 for 11 again.
Ouch. God, I'm so sorry that I don't have the montage of announcements of his full Padres career, his 0.000 batting average. And, you know, the thing with Cody Decker is, at the time, I liked Pat Murphy, like, as a person. Like, I enjoyed watching him as a manager.
He has that persona that you like in a manager.
At the time, if you recall, that was the year of Fire Mike D, and Mike D was still running the team. And the reason they didn't like Pat Murphy was because he just ignored their instructions. Like, they would be like, don't say anything about this injured player. And then in his interview with Darren Smith, he would obviously talk about that injured player. Like, to the point that they had to pull Pat Murphy out of interviews, and they actually assigned a team employee to sit with him for all interviews to make sure that he didn't say anything that wasn't authorized. And so,
this is a great footnote in Padres history, by the way, that I have forgotten.
Well, everyone writes off Pat Murphy as like, oh, well, he just is an interim manager that totally sucked. But it was an incredibly entertaining 3 months. Like, if anyone asked Darren Smith who one of his greatest manager interviews was, like, I have to imagine that Pat Murphy is at least top two, if not number one on his list. And so when Pat Murphy, who had Cody Decker at AAA El Paso for a long time, you know, saw what he was about, in his last couple weeks in San Diego, I believe as a favor to Cody, he had him called up to get him his taste of the major leagues. And like, I don't for a second believe Cody Decker was called up based on merit. Like, I think it was kind of like a lifetime achievement award for him. Like,
well, this is part of what makes it so funny too, is I was on the they should call him, like, what do they have to lose? Like, at that point in the season, you know, he had done so much at AAA, and I've already had a plan for years that the Padres should go for all this positive karma and sign a whole bunch of minor league free agents who have been toiling away for 10, 15 years and just put them on the field in September when the games are meaningless, which would also help you tank, by the way. So I was actually like pro call him up, which, you know, then when his career, you know, once he quit playing, I'm sorry, retired. I know, you know, the semantics are important here with him. Once he retired from playing baseball and became an analyst, you know, that's when I started to get fairly annoyed. I can't remember exactly what he did to get muted, but I know where I was. But in any case, yeah, I'm sure it made for a very entertaining day for everyone.
What?
There were a handful of people that were DMing me, like, just, you know, the skull emoji, like, just dead, but didn't want to say anything because for some reason Cody Decker's very beloved, which is why it made it such a great, great bit. I just love it.
Were you taken aback by how, like, Cody Decker to me is like, he's an interesting footnote in Padres history, and that's about it.
He's barely a footnote.
I mean, outside of like his,
it's like a toenail.
Outside of never getting a hit and like having a brief call up and failing at the major league level, like he did have like, I'm not going to call him legendary, but he was a storied, you know, career minor leaguer, right?
Yeah.
Which the San Diego media would pick up on, and like they loved him. I was a little surprised at how vigorous people were in defending him. Like the high and mighty, like Elston, I think, was like, Marver, this isn't it. Like, as if Cody Decker's like this bulletproof character who's not retweeted Barstool Sports for years. And like, it surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, he name searched himself and then went and responded to the semantics of how he is, you know, his time in San Diego ended. Dude, you got fucking cut. Like that's what it is. We could have added you to the 25-man roster and you would have stayed there, and we didn't, and so it's de facto cut. Call it what you want. Like, just come to terms with it. But in any case, he concluded his tweet by saying, whatever makes you sleep at night, or something like that. If he just came in and was like, actually, I became a minor league free agent, I would have been like, oh, okay, my bad. Like, or, you know, I wouldn't have been nearly as savage as I think I was.
Well, at the same time, but, it was very hilarious that you, someone who is presumably terrible at baseball, was commenting on his baseball skills. I also got a good chuckle out of that as well.
Certainly terrible in comparison to him. No, there's no question about that.
Well, no, I meant that. Objectively terrible. Objectively
definitely not
terrible.
Objectively terrible. You know, I got my All-Star jackets, and you know,
but that's okay.
That was pretty good.
Carlsbad Little League. That's like quintuple A. That's not important at all.
I think if you put me on the field, you'd be pretty surprised. Right?
I mean, that's not Encinitas Little League.
But regardless, I'm not disputing the fact that Cody Decker played minor league baseball pretty well for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a dispute.
Right.
What is in dispute is whether or not he should be proud of his major league career, which is, you know, I don't know. You know, I would very much have loved to have gone 0-11 in the pros, but at the same time, it is a nice area to poke fun at someone.
Well, and of course,
especially when they're being a dickhead to you.
Of course, what's not in question is also that you were objectively terrible at baseball as well, which makes the commentary extra hilarious, right? Objectively.
I mean,
terrible.
Sure. Definitely not terrible. I can't, by the way, we really should get a hardball game going. Like a bunch of people on Padres Twitter should play a hardball game. Because I really want to just mow down everyone in the lineup once through. I think that would be really fun.
Wait, with you on the mound?
Oh, yeah.
I'll
throw a couple innings.
All 5-7 of you? Like, what are you bringing? What are you bringing to the plate here?
We both know that I'm not 5'7".
5'8", I know.
No. But I think you'd be surprised. I can get it up to mid-70s still pretty easily without too much effort. And I think I can throw a couple innings at that pace, and I could definitely have some breaking pitches and some garbage. Change slot angles, and I do the Johnny Cueto, quick pitch shit. I did all of this, you must know that. I did like all that tricky shit.
I don't doubt it.
I would do the thing where I go out of the windup with a runner on and people would be like, what the fuck is he doing? And I make it look like I was pitching, but I took my non-throwing foot off the rubber and guys would run because they didn't know what the hell was going on. And it was just a major, I had all these tricks. I know a ton of tricks. And so, I think I could, I don't have confidence that people on Potter's Twitter would do a very good job hitting my stuff. I really don't.
I think I could pummel it.
I'm not sure. I really don't think you – I think you underestimate me here. But regardless, it's not even what the topic was. The topic was just how abbreviated his career was, which was
you remember the Wayne Partello misguided Swing for Your Seats campaign where everyone lined up at Petco Park and you got two pitches at 80 miles an hour, and if you hit a home run, you got season tickets, which –
mm-hmm.
Which the Phillies manager, Gabe Kapler, actually was there filming something with Donovan McNabb for Fox Sports that I don't think ever aired. And it was blazing hot, and I had a newborn child with me, probably 3 months old. And we were all there waiting, and then Gabe Kapler just cuts the line, and he's like, it's for the show. And he's like, I just got to hit one home run for the show. And then he then took 30 pitches, never hitting a single home run off of just an 80-mile-per-hour batting machine fastball, while we're all just roasting in the sun while he fails continually. I will never, ever forgive Gabe Kapler for that day. And his failure in Philadelphia, there's nothing that would make me happier than watching him continue to fail there for that inhumane treatment of the fans.
Well, I feel like they scientifically made it as hard as possible to hit home. 80 miles an hour is not enough momentum to, obviously the faster it comes in, the faster it goes out. And doing that seems purposeful to make it as difficult as possible to hit a home run.
Oh, I brought that up because
why not jack it up to 95? It's just a knob you can turn, I'm sure.
Let me tell you, there was not a lot of contact being made that day. I watched a lot of fans swing and miss it to actually, you only got one swing. You got two pitches in one swing. I saw a lot of swings and misses, whereas your old pal HJ hit a ball out of the infield, line drive over the shortstop, CW5 before it folded, interviewed me afterwards and put me on the news because I was the only person in my batch of people to make contact with the ball.
Nice. Yeah, that's when I got to shoot the three at the beginning of a Clippers game. Everyone airballing. I got three rims. Didn't go in. And then the guy behind me, he said he had never touched a basketball in his whole life. He must have been, I don't know, 50 years old, very overweight guy, goes up there and just swishes it. First shot he says he's ever taken his whole life. Then I had to take pictures for him because he's like, I don't think I'll ever be courtside again. I don't have the money. It was a great day for him. But
wait, what'd you do? You threw up air balls?
No. I did not throw up an air ball. Pretty much everyone before me threw up an air ball. I hit multiple rims.
Like a rim job? You had a rim
job?
No,
the ones where you shoot it, and you're like, oh, that's in. And it gives you, the completely perpendicular bounce off the rim. And then just kind of, rattles, like those ones. It was one of those.
But, satisfying rim job?
Yeah, very satisfying rim job. Yes, very satisfying. But I still got the participation mug. I didn't get the Blake Griffin jersey, the overweight 50-year-old guy who had never shot a basketball before in his entire life did.
Goddamn millennials.
It was incredible.
So anyways,
where were we?
The Cody Decker episode was a great distraction, I think, from some...
Oh, yeah. I would I was saying, I got a bunch of DMs from people who didn't want to come out publicly. And
didn't want to admit that they were attacking or supporting the attack of a quote-unquote beloved public figure.
Yeah, including one, you know, huge pussy, Eric LeBou, who just kept DMing me, you know, skulls. And then, you know, I'd be like, hey, just why don't you post that pussy? And didn't want to get involved. But also, I want to shout out Oscar for giving me the Brett Favre idea. That was great. You know, I really hope I took the most, or I really hope that my Favre reference did it for you.
Did he beat me to it? Because I was trying to spur you on also with material. You didn't use a lot of it.
I mean, I didn't need to use a lot of it. Like, it was very clear that just talking about his career was pissing him off enough. And he kept lobbing me softballs. I can't remember. One of them was like, I'm playing chess and you're playing Hungry Hungry Hippos or some shit like that. And I was like, well, I'm glad you found something else to play.
Right, but you did so by saying that Hungry Hungry Hippos, and again, objectively terrible game, it was underrated, which really only served to embarrass yourself.
No, I think there is, you know, I'm a big player of games, strategy games in particular. Hungry Hungry Hippos has very little, but there are some times where I like playing games that don't have much strategy as long as they're fun. So you have games like Candyland, where there's no strategy. You're just literally rolling a die and moving your pieces. Same with, or I guess Candyland, you're flipping over cards and moving it to the next colored candy or whatever. You have games like Chutes and Ladders, where you roll the die and you move it to the next thing. There's no strategy involved, and it's fucking boring. But Hungry Hungry Hippo, you're just jamming the shit out of this thing, eating as much of the shit as you can. And there's a little bit of strategy in like how you hit it and release it. You know, it's... I think it's underrated as far as mostly random games go. It was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun just hitting the shit out of it with my friends growing up.
Why are you just burning all your credibility on Hungry Hungry Hippos?
You know, I don't think I'm burning much credibility. I think there's people out there who will agree with me on this. I'm not saying I'm going to buy Isaac Hungry Hungry Hippos. I think we could do much better for games. But I still think it's underrated. I don't think it is as shitty as people think.
It's terrible. It's one of the worst games.
Also, by the way, this is an open invite to play a real game of chess with Cody Decker if he would love to be really embarrassed. If he really wants to be that embarrassed, and if he really does play chess, I would relish the opportunity.
All right, so let me ask you this to close out the topic.
Sure.
Cody Decker, which he declared in, I believe, all caps, is a paid on-air baseball personality. Is that right?
On-air insider,
that's right. So
barely inside, though. Mostly outside, you know. I would say, you know, 10.9 years outside, 0.1 years inside. But I guess that technically qualifies.
So it should be noted that he appears on the beloved Ben and Woods radio show in the mornings. And a big reason for that is because he is part of the Entercom/radio.com family. And Entercom just has a giant circle jerk of guests where they just provide their own quote-unquote insiders to appear on other radio shows, right? And that's what Cody Decker is. And by paid on air, that's actually a lie. He's not an on-air insider. He's a podcaster on radio.com.
Yeah, off-air.
Right.
That's called off-air.
I mean, he's as much on-air as we are, right?
Yes.
So if he ever invited you on his new podcast, would you be willing to appear as a guest?
Oh, of course.
Like, can we try to make that happen?
I mean, go for
like,
it.
Like,
I mean,
what if our tens of fans of this podcast started an online campaign to get Jen Sturger and Cody Decker to invite you onto that podcast? Do you think that you could verbally hold your own with a master wordsmith like Cody Decker?
Is that like an honest challenge? I mean, very easily.
Yeah.
I think – I don't – I bet you they would never air the episode. I think it would be – I would railroad them so hard they wouldn't
air. What do you mean air? They're a podcast.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't release it. That's what I mean.
I think we should start this campaign.
Yeah, go for it. I'll do it. I don't think he'll invite me on, and I don't think they'll release the episode because I think it'll be that much of a train wreck for them.
All right. Well, I'm going
to
organize.
I mean, assuming he wants to continue where we left off.
I will organize.
If he just wants to talk Padres baseball, that's fair. But
what does he know about Padres baseball? Like, why are we using him as an authority on Padres baseball?
Well, he knows. I mean, he knows an awful lot about the buses back and forth between Tulsa and El Paso.
Knows a lot about cheese sandwiches.
He probably has great opinions on, you know, Big League Chew, sunflower seeds, Gatorade, Pink Slips,
Jeff Francoeur.
You know, Jeff Francoeur. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the extent of his knowledge. I don't know.
Well, I'm counting this as a challenge. I am going to follow through on this. This will be a major internet campaign.
Go for it. Is this going to be as successful as your Get Alexi Amarisa into the All-Star Game campaign that resulted with a not even top 15 finish?
Here's the thing. Everyone remembers the campaign, and that's really what matters.
I don't think anyone really remembers the campaign. I think it's like a niche artifact in Padres Twitter lore. Like, I remember it because it was highly unsuccessful, but...
I'm not going to lie. It was more successful than Vote Kinsler was this year.
That's true. That is true.
Do we want to talk any real Padre stuff? There was a major development today when, speaking of the beloved Ben and Wood show sponsored by Dietz and Watson, Ron Fowler appeared on the radio, which we used to take for granted when he would appear every week, and now it's like a major event when he shows up. Did you listen to the interview?
I did not. I was actually working and quite busy today, but I did follow along on Twitter and saw some of the major quote nuggets that got thrown out there. Why don't you recap it for everyone?
So it was mostly uneventful. In my opinion, most of the Ron Fowler interviews going forward are probably going to be uneventful. In fact, this is my theory, but I personally think, and let's just say I've heard some things that it's quite possible that questions are submitted in advance to Ron Fowler so that there are no longer any surprises or there's no unprepared answers, which is really what we desire out of a Ron Fowler interview, right? So I don't think we're ever going to get any major bombshells anymore. And Ron Fowler was very guarded in things that he said. The only thing that he very directly said was, is Andy Green in trouble? No. He says no. I'm not sure it was a definitive statement. I think it's, I don't know, cover, who knows.
The thing is that, like, I don't think he can say yes.
Right. Like, he would fire him. Like, if the answer was yes and he could say that, he would just fire him.
I mean, even if the answer is yes and he's in trouble, which is still like a subjective term, like, you don't want your manager to be managing with that in mind, right? You want him to think there's peace of mind and for him to continue to do things that put the Padres that give the Padres the best odds of winning the World Series going forward, as opposed to, for example, trying to win meaningless games here at the end of the year when they don't matter, right? Running Tatis out there every single day, even if he has a minor injury, you know, we don't want Andy Green in that position because he's in trouble. That would just not be good.
Right.
So I'm not surprised with his answer.
However, in the last week, since we podcasted last, it's become quite a bit more apparent, and it seems to be, you know, the beat writers that formerly would white knight for Andy have kind of turned the corner and started basically predicting his demise at the end of the season, which is a major change. In my opinion, like, the writing's on the wall at this point. Like, short of winning 20 in a row, like, even to just go 500 at this point, the team has to go 28-20. It's...
Dude, they haven't won two in a row since the All-Star break.
I'm checking the score right now.
I mean, they're probably going to do it tonight, but...
Just to be safe. But, probably going to do it. Yeah, they just scored 4 runs. They're probably going to do it tonight. So there you go. They have to go 27-20 going forward to be 500 at the end of the year.
It's not crazy.
It's not crazy, but it's not likely. Like,
it's really not likely once you consider that Paddock's going to get shut down. Mackenzie Gore is not getting called
up.
The
schedule is difficult. It's difficult. It's going to be difficult to put a ton of wins together when you've got, like, the Rays coming to town. You've got the Red Sox. Like, there's, like, the Dodgers. Like, there's it's just not built to go off on a 10-game winning streak right now. And in my opinion, when AC starts openly, you know, everything short of saying he's going to get fired, like, I think kind of the writing's on the wall, probably.
Yeah, and the other part of this, too, is that, you know, last year Ron Fowler explicitly said they weren't going to sign Manny Machado for $300 million, and then they literally did that. So,
Well,
I don't know how much I can take his opinions at face value anymore.
Well, that brings me to the other, I guess, major statement that he made. To Stephen Woods' credit, he asked a direct question of, you know, fans are talking about the need to get to a league average payroll, which is, according to the data, absolutely mandatory to be a World Series champion. And so Ron Fowler basically dodged the question. He did say that their goal is to trade for the improvements, and if that doesn't work, then they will be forced to, I think he said, quote, spend some money. So he never actually answered the question. He never addressed the fact of whether they will or won't have a league average payroll. He basically just said that, the payroll's going up anyways because Will Myers Will Myers is getting paid more, which basically offsets and increases over any dead money that they're paying this year. And B, that, you know, they'll spend, quote, spend money on something. To me, it did not sound like they were going to sign Gerrit Cole, who, of course, is this podcast's desired target for the offseason. And then to follow that up, actually, Kevin Acey, I guess I saw quotes posted later from 1360 where Kevin Acey basically said that they will not sign a $30 million pitcher. They're looking for something cheaper. Possibly a pitcher that they can, quote, absorb the salary of. So,
meaning they want to get someone who's not that good but overpaid and basically get him for free? I mean, that's what I get when I hear absorb the salary.
That's what I heard. Padres Farm disputes that interpretation. So I don't know. I didn't listen to it. I tried to tune into 1360 today at my house just driving to lunch, and it's tremendously terrible, the signal from that. Like, have you tried from the methane cloud? Did the methane amplify the signal at all for you?
I'm not going to dignify these this methane conspiracy anymore.
It's not a conspiracy. I posted a photo. 1360
is not very clear here anymore.
I posted a photo of the methane leaking out of the garbage dump that your house is built on.
What? This is.
I'll post it again if you want.
Yeah, post it again. I need to see this Photoshop job.
like 1360. Like, I'll have to just tune in for my work on. But I have a strong suspicion that I won't be able to pick it up past, let's say, Carmel Valley. Probably, right?
I mean, I get it. I it's just not very clear. It's like really soft, and my car goes up to 30 on the volume, and I always have to listen to 1360 at like 25.
But then, like, static overtakes it. Like, I want nothing more than to support, you know, friend of the show Darren Smith. You know, we are the first, of course, just to toot our own horn, we're the first podcast to have Darren Smith on as an interview. But aside from that, I want to support Darren, and it's very difficult with this awful signal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super excited he's back on the air, though. You know, I haven't been much of a listen to it live person. I tend to use the online apps or go back and listen to specific interviews. But just the fact he's on the air is great. I don't think we touched upon it last podcast, but very happy to hear.
Very happy. I mean, it's good to have an honest voice, right? That's unencumbered. Yeah. We've always said this. It's good to have a voice that's unencumbered and can be an independent voice.
Yeah, and I'm very happy that he's not on 97.3 and that he ended up somewhere where, like you said, it's going to be much more of an independent voice than if you end up, you know, under some sort of team or at least
the flagship,
you know,
the banner of the flagship.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, that's the Fowler interview. I definitely do want to listen to it. I probably will listen to it this weekend while I do some yard work or something, but yeah, I'm curious to hear everything that was said.
And so,
that was on the Ben and Woods show this morning.
It did kind of get me thinking, though. Like, in my head, like, the obvious solution, if you want to take the team from what it is now, which is a team that will probably finish in the low to mid 70s for wins, up to, I don't know, what's our target to be? He also, I will say, Ron Fowler never actually said that they were competing for a World Series next year or a championship, which I would like to hear at some point from the team that is the goal. To me, it's actually very annoying and very disheartening that there is never, like, when was the last time you heard the team state that its goal was to win a championship? because all we hear is we're looking in 2020 to field a competitive team. And this is something that Mike D would use to – I mean, he said this in 2015 and 2016. AJ and Fowler said this in 2017 and 2018. Like, it's always to be competitive. And competitive is kind of a loaded phrase because there is no definition of what that is. Like, is that the fringe of the wild card? Is that winning a wild card? Or is that competing for a championship? Because to me, only one of those options actually matters to me as a fan.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's every year you didn't win the World Series is a failure. I mean, it really is. It doesn't mean that the year itself was all bad, but it just means that, you know, you didn't achieve your goal.
In every game, the goal is to win the game, right? And in baseball, to win the game, you win the World Series.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that as my I would say they have said it a couple times. I think Seidler might have said it. But when he asked me that, I couldn't name you the last time that I, you know, remember hearing it. But yeah, the whole compete in the September nonsense is very old.
Fowler has never said it. Like, I will go through at some point. I will say it's very painful going through these Cilio, Fowler, Gruppner interviews that I have. I have the full library of them. And I've been starting to listen to them to create a supercut of Ron Fowler declaring that 2019 was going to be competitive and 2020 was going to be the World Series team. And I've been going back and listening, and it's crazy to hear the same rhetoric from 2016 and 2017 just being repeated today. Like, I cut this quote of Eric Gruppner from 2017 where he's like, he, you know, 2017 was a pretty dreadful year. That was the year where I think they finished above their Pythagorean, but they still won like 71 or 72 games. Like, it was a terrible year. And Eric Gruppner at the end of the year was like, you know, I would say that the season is a success because we got a chance to see all of the young players that are going to be key parts of the next, you know, of the future good Padres teams. And it's great to see these young players that give it their all, try hard, and leave everything out on the field. And it really gives fans a taste of where we're going with this plan. And you could basically replay the quote in 2016, in 2017, in 2018, and you could play that same quote in 2019, and no one would know that it was from 2 years prior. And so it was a little disheartening to me to hear that. Really, I'm not going to say the situation is different. Like, we didn't have Fernando Tatis in 2017. We had, like, Tommy Medica or some other garbage player. But the rhetoric has stayed the same from leadership. And to me, that sets... That's not the tone that I want to hear from leadership. I want to hear championship. I want to hear that winning a championship is the goal.
Yeah, and I don't want to... Yeah. Yeah, that's... I don't know. I've had that complaint for so, so long. You know, particularly during the Garf years. And all the Morad years of... yeah. I mean... If you're not in it to win the whole champion, like if that is not your goal, like for example, if the Padres won the World Series once, if all of these international signings and Tatis and all of these draft picks, we make the playoff one time only and win the World Series, that is a tremendous success. If they make the playoffs five times and don't win the World Series once, that is a failure. Like that's the, you know, the extent to which I emphasize winning the whole thing. Like, that's all that I care about. Anything else to me is, you know, ancillary. Obviously, I want to enjoy watching the games, but that's still second to, like, actually rooting for a team to win it all. Because I've never experienced that. I mean, I've kind of sort of rooted for the Lakers back in the Shaq Kobe years, but it didn't feel the same, you know? And then I sat first row of the end zone for all the Chargers games that they played in San Diego, and obviously we know how that ended. So I need to – it's something that, like, that's all I care about, really. That's it.
Are you up to date on Make the Padres Great Again?
I don't listen to him too much, but I definitely follow the conversation about the episodes. Are you referring to the Tatis extension?
No. We can get to that in a second. It's actually building off what you just said. Craig Elston, who I respect his opinion quite a bit and enjoy it, He was very drunk on the last episode, and I loved it. But he's made the point before that the worst case scenario is that this Padres window is the Pirates, right? The Pirates were very good. It's just that they never could turn the corner in the playoffs because either their division was stacked or they would lose, and they'd continually get these one game playoffs and lose, or you know, they would get a single playoff series. And that's the ultimate fear, right? That we become that, or we're the Rays or something like that, where, you know, we're good and they win, but they never win a championship. And I think it was the episode prior, Craig actually laid out that scenario and said, in his opinion, that was not a failure. If they become the Pirates, that's not a failure. We tried, we executed a plan, they were winning, but they didn't win a championship. And in his opinion, he thought that it was unfair to consider that a failure. And for me personally, that's a tremendous failure. If we go through this just decade-long rebuild and build, and there is no world championship at the end of it. Like to me...
Yeah, of course that's a failure. I mean, I don't see how you could say otherwise. You can still say the plan was the correct plan to execute. It didn't turn out the way you wanted. You know, maybe even there's maybe some, you know, you get a little bit unlucky during that. Like, whatever. Like, there are other ways to describe it, but you should make no mistake, that would still be a failure.
Well,
it could be an unlucky failure. It could have been, you know, a well-executed failure, but it's still a failure.
I had a discussion on Twitter with Padres Farm, who is much maligned, I believe, on Padres Twitter sometimes, but his Luis Urias bit is a little heavy-handed, possibly. But I personally believe that his goal is similar to mine, in that they should execute moves to lead to a championship, that is the goal for every move. And we had a discussion on what the window was, what the most realistic window was. Like, to you, what do you think the prime years of this competitive window is?
I mean, I honestly still don't think next year is that unrealistic, provided they fix, you know, just top of the rotation. Like, I feel pretty strongly that Mackenzie Gore is going to be great as soon as next year. Like, just based on similar players in the past to him, like, whether or not that's a 4-win above replacement pitcher or a 7-win above replacement pitcher is, you know, what we're going to have to, you know, watch closely. But still, I have some optimism for that. Obviously, there's a lot of young players on this team who are going to continue to get better. We've seen it towards the end of this year. Francisco Mejia is now hitting like 270. Urias is even coming around. Obviously, Tatis, his OPS is still like 1,000. Like, there's a lot of reasons to be excited about the youth on the team, but they still, like, so, you know, it gives me some hope that I don't think next year is totally unreasonable. But if you're asking me, like, what is the dead prime of all these years?
Well, no, I mean, I'm saying...
I think you start to look at...
Given the assets, you know, on this team and this roster, mm-hmm. like Manny Machado is now 27. He's mm-hmm. firmly in his prime years. So what I'm asking is, given the assets, as the front office, what years do you target as the most important years of the window?
I don't know if you might, you know,
because if you say 2024, well, then I'll say, well, Manny Machado is going to be 31 or 32 then. Like, arguably too late.
I wouldn't say that. I would say it needs to be, I would probably go 2023 maybe, because Tatis will be 23 or 20. What will he be then?
He'll be 24, I think. But 24,
Machado will be 30.
He'll be 31, you know, like, by then.
Okay, so maybe 2022 then. You know, I'm starting to look at, like, where is Tatis going to start to come into his prime while Machado's still on the tail end of his? Then you got to figure
those arms. And
then
don't forget,
we're
stuck with Hosmer, who is now 30 and now is on the downside. So no matter what we say, Hosmer's here, right? And in all likelihood will be played. So, like, there's this delicate balancing act of, like, we're stuck with certain assets that are going to be used, right? And I don't mean stuck with, like, Manny. I mean, Manny Machado, you were blessed with that. But there's, like, this balancing act where you need to hit on all cylinders at the same time. And that doesn't just mean prospects. That also means, you know, the established superstars that the team has brought in. Like, to me, the most important years of this window are 2000 to 2022. That's Manny Machado's age, 28, 29, 30 year. Beyond that, I start to worry that we miss the best that Machado has to offer. And you start looking at like 34, 35-year-old Hosmer. And so when there's a question of like, well, 2020 is kind of marginal. Like, I don't know, should we go for it? Like, to me, the answer is yes, absolutely. Machado's 28 next year. That's as prime as you can be. And so I don't want to miss that window based off his prime. I don't want to wait till Eric Hosmer can't stand up straight because his back is hurt because he's in his mid-30s. Like, to me, like, I think there's this impulse to prospect hoard that we can't possibly trade Tirso or Nellis in low A or wherever he is, Arizona League, because he's a great prospect. But I think that there is a need to start cashing in those prospects for an immediate upgrade, because if we don't immediately upgrade a lot of these positions, we're totally missing our superstars' prime window.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. But if you're asking me for what year itself is probably the highest odds, I'm going to go with the year where
I agree.
Tatis is closer to his prime, Machado's still on the tail end of his, you know, Goran Patino, or whoever else comes through and ends up being good, or
I think
in their low 20s and still healthy like that. Those are the years that I look at.
I think 2022 is it. Like, if I were to bet on a year, I think that's the year. But I don't want to miss it. And so like when you and I advocate for like a Gerrit Cole, it's based to me, that's based on the idea that you need to capitalize on the next 3 years. And like, yeah, you can hold on to Patino and he's going to be good. I don't have any doubts about that. But like, the question in my head is, does this prospect help the 2020 to 2022 window? Does he make this a championship club more so than another player that could fill that roster spot? And to me, like, I think I've worked through a lot of this. Like, Urias is a little different because he's immediate help. But Patino is kind of like just starting in Double A. Like, maybe he's going to be here. Maybe he's on an innings limit. Like, I don't know what his impact is going to be on that next championship team in the window that I've defined in my head as the most important. And so, like, when we ask the question of like, how do we get from here a 72 win team to there a championship team? Like, I think that there is going to have to be some kind of reckoning of prospects that we all love that we also believe will be great major leaguers to kind of change the time frame of what assets will benefit this team in the correct time frame.
Yeah, I just hope that when they make deals like that, that they're really getting back really high-end guys in return. Like, I don't want them giving away, you know, a lot of their prospect depth for Marcus Stroman. You know, like a mid-rotation, ho-hum sort of guy. Like, I really hope it is another piece who fits better in that window, who's young and, you know, it doesn't have to be controllable for too long, but, you know, you're hoping at least 2 years to coincide with, the 2022 sort of apex window there. But, you know, I don't know. And again, sometimes, I don't know. I worry they're going to get trigger happy. And
what do you think of the emphasis that's being placed on 2020? Because from ownership, we are hearing that 2020 is a pivotal year, right? And I would argue that for Joe Dickhead fan, that 2020 is critical in buying in on all of this. That ownership has said this, like, going back and listening to these interviews, like, ownership has said this for now through 2016, 2017, 2018, now 2019. 4 years, they've declared that 2020 is going to be either competitive or a World Series team.
Well, I mean, they've even said 2019, as you said. But yeah. Yeah, it's hard for me to look. So many people still went to the games when they had Jeff Morat as owner, when they had the lowest, shittiest payrolls in baseball, when they weren't even signing premier players in the draft when they had the opportunity to. People still went. So it's hard for me to say that they really have to convince Joe Dickhead. I think Joe Dickhead is a lot more flimsy than we think.
Oh, what? Have you not checked Facebook lately? Padres Facebook lately?
I don't have a Facebook. I have not checked Facebook in quite some time. No.
I think you
just have people that are going to have those opinions no matter what. And it's like, you know, how much can you really impact someone's opinion that way? I think there's certainly a subset of fans that might look at it as some sort of credibility sort of thing. But I think any fan who's looking at it and has like a value system, whether like, you know, this team has to earn my trust in 2020, is probably also intelligent enough to see the bigger picture of the prospects and everything else, and at least have some sort of understanding. Like if they're bad again next year, let's just say that next year they win 78 games, for the sake of the argument, and that's with calling up Mackenzie Gore, and he's good. You know, if I don't know, they might lose 78 even. There's just a lot of randomness in the results of baseball games. A good team can win only 78 in a season. I hope they don't make rash decisions based solely on that. Like, I hope that they still, you know, take a stock of their assets and then make decisions based on that stock. Because I feel like in the past they did, like, kind of the opposite, where, you know, the team would win 72, and then the next year they win 76 and be like, look at this improvement, and look how good they were in September. And well, instead of actually taking a step back and looking at their assets and being like, well, shit, we don't have anything still.
Well, they're hoping, like, they're like hoping
they
to
won
do
a
that.
Bunch of random games.
I mean, they're hoping to do that this year, right? I mean, like let's say they have a hot September. I mean, the result of that is like, well, you know, I think Will Myers is working out in left. Like, we don't need to upgrade left field. Or it's like let's say let's say for whatever reason Francisco Mejia falls apart, right? And Ed just never learns to hit. It's like, well, I don't know. Like, maybe we can live with that catching situation. Like, I just feel like that breeds acceptance of mediocrity when you get that little late surge.
Potter's just won, by the way.
So they've won two in a row.
First two-game winning streak. Yeah, woo.
The season saved for Andy. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think they're quite that flimsy anymore from a decision-making perspective. I think the Machado one, when they signed Machado, they really did earn a lot from me, because I think it was a recognition of, look, we have all this young talent coming up. We need to supplement it with something huge. And they did. And it was a major investment. And I put a little bit of stock in that because I think it deserves some stock.
Sure.
So I think I really – and you and I have talked about it a bunch. I really hope they're not counting on Garrett Richards. Like, I hope there's no complacency, which is the word there, with the roster. Because although I can see how they can get there without adding externally – they should still add externally. Like, whenever you're close to a window and you feel like you have a competitive team, you should always be adding. You should never be like, nope, this is just enough. This is it. We're good. Like, this team could win in theory. We're not going to add anything more. It's always the wrong way to approach it, I think.
So let me ask this. This is an idea that I've been thinking about, and you tell me if I'm off base on it. Since the days of Mike D, ownership and leadership has talked about waves of talent, right? And the theory was that each year there would be this continual wave of new talent, and this kind of applies to the idea of whether they should hoard their prospects or whether they need to cash in. Like, in my opinion, the 2016 wave is an unmatched by quantity and by quality wave, right? And that's aided by rules that allowed them to acquire just like a boatload of international prospects. In Of course, Ron Fowler negotiated that away in the next CBA, so that it could never be a strategy that's repeated. But they have this glut of talent, right? That was signed in that year and has moved through the system together to be a tidal wave of talent, right? And as we're kind of seeing, because there's a lot more discussion of like 25-man and 40-man roster spots, you can only fit so many of them on a roster, because even though they may be good prospects and Fangraphs has rated them and Baseball America has said they are 45, you know, future value prospects, there's only so much room for 45 future value prospects, right? And so they can either languish in Double A and never sniff the major leagues, because even though they are good prospects, they're not good enough to advance to a major league roster. Like, I think that there's this desire to fetishize prospect ratings and prospect evaluations, and that we can't possibly trade them because they'll be good someday. But at some point, I think that we all need to reconcile with the idea that we will trade players that will be in the major leagues, that will likely be good players, but we are doing so to replace them with players that are better than them.
Or at least coincide with us winning.
Timing-wise, right, because a 45 future value player that won't be that good until 2024 doesn't help us hit that window when Manny Machado is at his most productive.
Yeah,
like, am I off of that? Because what I would say is that all of the waves after 2016, I'm not going to say they're not bad waves, but they will never be as big or as productive as that 2016 wave again. Like from that point forward, it's a trickle of international players thanks to the CBA signed by Ron Fowler, and it is draft picks, and that's it. So, you know,
I mean you can always have a pseudo wave, but that would require like 1 year you draft high school players, and like 2 years later you draft a whole bunch of college players, right? Like,
right, and that's something.
That's one way to kind of line them
but,
up.
But it will never be like 2016 again.
No, you have to rely on luck. You have to rely basically on draft luck,
right,
in order to have that sort of wave. And it's not like there aren't teams that have exhibited that over the years. I mean, the Cardinals seem to always have a wave of players coming through. The Dodgers recently just seem to produce a superstar every year. So it's not like it's like,
but it's not necessarily untenable. It's not necessarily a glut. Like I think the 2016 crop of players is actually a glut of players. Like the Dodgers players eventually seem to wind their way onto the major league roster. You know, the top prospects do.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way for the Padres talent from the 2016 crop to join the major league team. Like, there's too many of them. Like that's what every prospect writer has said, that our system is ranked number one because of its incredible depth. And depth is good, as you wrote, you know, except for Franmil Reyes, of course, in your opinion. But outside of that case, like, depth is great, but at some point you can have too much depth. Like, you can have too much depth to actually be able to turn it into something productive at the major league level. And I think that when we're faced with a 2022 window, like, right now is the time to cash in those players for something that will help in that window, because I don't think that those prospects are necessarily the most valuable path to build a championship team in that window.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an extent to which depth is not as useful as using those assets in other ways. Like, I think on the front end of the getting into the competitive quote window, having a lot of depth really helps, because you have more rocks and more lottery tickets that might turn into solid foundational pieces, right? If you only have three or four of them, like we saw a couple of years ago with what was it? Renfro, Margot, Hedges, and Asuahe. Those were our four.
This actually reminds me the Eric Rupner interview that I listened to. He actually called out. He was like, you know, what's really exciting is all of the activity we've got thanks to our great draftees and signings in the international from the Dominican in the minors. And he started naming names, and it was like, well, we had Matt Whistler in single A, like he's blowing him away, and like he's pretty much a sure thing. He's about to hit double A, and I think we're pretty confident he's got ace level stuff. And then we've got Walter Weichel in the minor leagues, and he's going to be here before long. Like, he's really impressing in single A. Like, it's just this constant cycle of it's like yeah, they're a good prospect. Like, and no one doubted Walter Weichel. Like, he was a good prospect at the time. It's just like, you got to cash him in sometimes. Like sometimes they're not going to help at the major league level.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess, like you said, there is a limit to the number of guys you can have in your 40 man or your 25 man. I guess for me, it's just nice to see that there's so many young options that, you know, at least a couple of them will be useful. And then you need to supplement that with, you know, your Manny Machados and other, you know, smaller signings and possibly another top line ace, right? And then you continue to have minor leaguers come through, and you hope that you build major league depth by using your, you know, farm system.
Well, and that's the thing with like these.
But then once you have that built, you know, then yeah, you're looking at how can we upgrade it at a position? Well, we can consolidate some of the depth that we have into a better starter at this position. Like, though, I mean, that's just the logical way of approaching it, which is what you see the championship level teams do.
Well, isn't that the thing? Like, it used to be the top 10 prospect list was what everyone looked at. Now it's top 30, or in some cases top 100, thanks to you, Marver, for starting that top 100. But like,
I didn't do 100, I did 75.
But like I've always said, like, the top 10 is what I personally am most concerned with, because those are the cream of the crop. Like you said, you have many lottery tickets, and you take the winning tickets, and those are the ones that are going to wind up on a major league roster.
Mm-hmm.
I can say, like, well, it's great the Padres have this deep system, and number 27 would be number 9 in any other system. But for the Padres, being number 27 doesn't matter. because number 27 isn't going to get on to the 25-man roster. And, like, those are – like, that's the kind of depth that I think that a lot of people are so – I think everyone's worried about losing the trade, right? This is something John Gennaro talked about on Make the Padres Great Again. Like, there's this fear GMs have of having an article written that says they lost the trade because so-and-so turned out to be good later, right? And I think I think there should be some realization that a lot of our 10 through 40 prospects – are probably going to make the major leagues at some point, and we will look at them and be like, man, he just had a good start. Like, I think that's good, but you know that hurts, right? A little bit. That's going to hurt us all because we watch them come up. But like, if we can turn those into productive assets for the window when we can actually win a championship, like that's in my head the number one priority for this front office. Like, don't worry about the backlash or what could happen with those players. Do what makes the team most likely to win a championship between 2020 and 2022. That's my priority here.
Yeah, I think I agree with that to a pretty large extent. But I would hesitate in trading some of the major league talent they have now as part of those major deals.
Well, we're past...
Unless you're really sure.
Except for Fran Mill, right?
You know, he's fringy. I'm talking more about the Urias and, you know.
Well, and see, that's the thing. The window matters. It's not just the prospect rating or the prospect evaluation. It's the window that they're going to be useful to this team. Not just to be called up, but to be championship caliber. Like Gore, I think that we can all agree, Gore is a piece that will help this team win a championship in that window, right? There are certainly prospects that we all love that might be in low A or high A or whatever that are great prospects but may not help this team be championship level when they need to be. Not that they're worthless, but like that's my – really, to me, that's the emphasis here.
Yeah, and I think it makes some sense.
Speaking of long-term moves, we talked about Make the Padres Great Again. Elston floated, and I think he was possibly extremely intoxicated and hilarious when he said this. And I'm not, I think it was a little tongue in cheek, but he blurted out that if Tatis, who is objectively great, wants to sign a extension, the Padres should sign him to a $500 million extension. Is there a limit on A, I think there's this assumption that Tatis wants to sign an extension, which is totally unknown. And if we're being honest, like Manny Machado in the clubhouse should probably be, if I were Manny, I'd probably be saying, look at me, like, kid, you're better than me and you're going to hit the free agent market at 25. Like, just hold tight. But beyond that, is there a limit at the dollar value that you would want to offer Fernando Tatis as an extension?
I mean, obviously there's always a limit, but like $500 million in 10, for 10 years is absolutely fucking absurd. Like, it's like way more money than it would actually take to sign him. Like maybe twice, at least twice as much.
What do you think? What do you think Tatis would get on the free agent market? Like, let's say he hits
in 5 years.
Let's say he,
or I guess, in,
yeah. Let's say he hits the market at 25. Let's say he continues his. Let's say he doesn't even advance. Like, what's he going to be this year if he played a full year? 6 WAR, shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say he never turns into an 8 WAR like megastar. He's just a steady 6 WAR. That's Manny Machado, basically. I'll add 6 WAR. What do you think he gets on the open market, given inflation, new CBA, all of that, in 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only going to talk about it in like 2019 dollars. I think it's too hard to kind of like translate them between the years.
Oh,
so.
To see what President Beto will do on monetary policy.
President Beto. Oh man, that was good.
Machado just got 300, right? I mean, Harper just got 330. Like it's got to be like $500 million, right? Like, given salary inflation, what do you think Mookie Betts is going to get? Like, he's going to get more than Machado, right?
I don't know. It's actually really difficult to predict these things because the broader Major League Baseball market has changed so much. Like it's hard to say that the new CBA that goes in place will, you know, not be so tremendously different that it will change the actual values of all the contracts that have been signed.
I mean, I'm basing this on somewhat of an assumption that the players' union will somehow improve the free agent market for their members.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing. If he waits until then, sure, he could probably and he's still super good. He could probably get a 10-year deal. Yeah, like
at least $400 million, right? Pretty safe to say.
Sure. So, well, no, I don't know if that's safe to say. In $400 million in 2019 dollars, I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know if you get that.
Actually, no. I'm thinking in 2025 dollars.
Yeah, I mean, it's too hard in today's value for me to. I guess I'm
let's say 350 in today's dollars.
Sure. So, but that contract will sign him through age what 35?
35.
Yeah. So he's going to hit free agency and have almost, well, limited value going forward, potentially no value. Whereas if he signs an extension now, if he signed a 10-year deal now, he would be signed through his age 30 year, and he would still hit free agency around the same time that everyone else hits free agency. And would still be in line to get a tremendously large deal. You know, the way that his salary is going to work now is obviously he's going to get paid very little for this next year. He'll probably then get Super 2 status and get paid a little bit in arbitration and then start to make increasingly large figures in arbitration before hitting free agency. I don't know. I think that if you offered him...
We're not getting him for Acuña, right?
There's an assumption here that he's even open to the conversation. What's that?
Like, we're not getting him for Acuña's contract. Like, I think there's this belief that that somehow is a precedent for Tatis. I think that's an anomaly, not a market setter.
I think the Albies and Acuña ones are more or less a testament to how poor their agents were.
Yes.
I don't think it's a market setting sort of contract. And I don't see that being the case.
I think it actually hurts the case that Acuña has actually been better this. Like, it's one thing if Acuña was good last year, signed this big extension, and then turned into – it was like Byron Buxton, where he has a good year, he has a terrible year. Like, it's very
– yeah,
you know,
up and down, but you can see the potential.
Inconsistent, right? Acuña has actually been much better this year than last year, which makes his contract even more laughable at this point. Like to other players, I think that sends the lesson that Acuña left a lot, even more on the table now than he did in the offseason, where everyone agreed that he left, you know, a ton on the table.
Yeah, no, I agree. Totally. But I think that, you know, if you offered today Fernando Tatis Jr. 10 years and $250 million, he would accept it. I think he would. Whether or not it's smart to do that, I'm not sure. I honestly don't know if it's smart to do that. It's still... I'm not questioning that he's going to be a good player, but it's still limited data. To be fair, if they offered him 10-250 and accepted, I would still be thrilled. It's not my money, and it would mean that we're getting to have Tatis for 10 years, which would be fucking phenomenal.
I will say this is going to be an unpopular opinion because everyone thinks the players should be paid whatever, even though their players union agreed to the rules and whatever, but I go back to that window of 2020 and 2022, right? Is the team better if Tatis is being paid pre-ARB salaries for 2 years and then whatever his ARB 1 salary will be, which generally is not a huge sum of money? That's the window, right? And so isn't it better for the team if he's not making $25 million a year in 2020, 2021, 2022? For the team, it's better, right?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I guess that makes sense. But then you start getting into that window where it's like, well, now that he's close enough to free agency, he's just going to go to free agency. Does that mean now we have to look beyond and cash out our assets?
Look, the price goes up, right?
Yeah.
But is it worth it? Is it worth it to maximize the window? To have Tatis making $500,000 next year so that they can fit in, let's say in a fantasy, Gerrit Cole on the roster's payroll, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can still win
in the window.
You can sign someone to a tremendous extension and still, you know, backload that contract.
Yeah.
It's not like something they can't do. Maybe it costs them another $20 million to do it long term, but
But if what you really care about is that short term dollar figure, I mean, there's ways to do that. I just think 10,500 is absolutely fucking laughably absurd.
I will say though, I think that it's been underrated that Tatis is supremely confident. Like, that's very clear to us, right? He's supremely confident in his skills and abilities, right? He's some would say cocky. And I think that those are personality traits that don't lead someone to bet against themselves with an extension. I think Manny Machado is supremely cocky and backs it up. And I think that's – I have no doubt that at some point he was presented with an extension offer and chose to decline it and bet on himself to go to free agency. And I look at Tatis, and he's – his personality tells me that he's not the guy to sell himself short with an extension. I'm not saying it's impossible, because obviously there's a price on everyone, but but I think there's this assumption that's like, well, if the Padres just offer a fair deal, he'll take it. And I don't think it's that simple.
No, I don't think it is either. And I also don't think – actually, I honestly don't think Tatis would accept a 10-year deal. Like, I don't think that is as conducive to him financially. Well, like why would he accept that? Because he can do a kind of a little bit of both, right? He can accept maybe a 2-year extension with – and get some monetary certainty, right? So we could sign him, you know, now to, I guess, what would be then a 7-year deal or an 8-year deal for close to the same annual value. And that'll allow him to hit free agency at 27 or 28 as opposed to 30. Like, I think you know, a 10-year deal itself might be something which is untenable for him. Because why would he sign that when he could – like, if he's going to go to – I guess 30 isn't the worst time to hit free agency, but I just see an extension with him being either really, really long, like extremely long, or, like, just, like, a buying out a year or two of his free agency. I think those are more of the options there.
Well, the thing with Tatis also is that he's not in dire need of money, right? Like, he's from familial wealth. He signed a deal with BLA, who's the Big League Advance, who advances a large sum of money for a share of future earnings. Like, he's not – it's not like he needs to sign an extension to improve his lifestyle. Like, he's already rich. He's a rich kid. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. Don't get me wrong. It would be great if they extended him. I just don't think it's – I don't think it'll be easy, and I don't think it'll be cheap. And so part of me thinks let's win a championship. Let's just do what it takes to win a championship, right? And that may be waiting on extending Tatis. There's not a rush. Like, the price goes up, sure, in year three, but, like, you can still extend him then.
I don't know. I think if there was a reasonable deal to be had that would extend him for 2 years, I think that's a pretty fair – like, I would commit to that. Even at a cost of increasing his proportion of our salary over the next 2 years. I think just having him on the roster for those extra 2 years is worth it.
Yeah, it's great. It's worth it, I guess. But it depends on what the price – like anything, it depends on the price, right?
Sure. Sure. Yeah I guess.
I'm trying to find how much BLA paid him. It may not be disclosed, but he's got money. He's got money. So let's see. I'm trying to think if we had any. I believe that is all of our show prep, Marver.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, not much show prep, but it's something.
Right. Let me just check the list here. Let's see. Marver being a total dickhead to Cody Decker, getting from here to there, Tatis Jr. Yeah, I think we're good.
Yeah, I think that's everything.
Oh, and Marver being objectively terrible in Little League. I think we've got everything.
That one, I don't know about that one. But, yeah, it was a good discussion. And, you know, hopefully there'll be someone else that can shit on Twitter in the next week or two, and we'll have another podcast.
Yeah, well, hey, maybe we should just take a dump on Tom Garfinkel, who's apparently taking a dump on his own head this week, which must have pleased you to no end.
Oh, God, it was great. And, you know, the thing is, I actually kind of agree a little bit with his point, which makes it really tough, which is that people should be allowed – or I don't know. People should be allowed to donate to who they want to donate to without it meaning that they're the fucking worst person in the world. But
I didn't realize that. Just treating actions didn't have consequences. that everyone lives in a consequence-free zone.
I mean, I think at some level he was talking about Stephen Ross's actions and the charities that he set up and all those sort of things. Now, whether or not he's done that for tax purposes, you know, maybe. I don't know. I don't look at the finances, but I guess there's a little bit more outrage than I think is warranted for what he's saying, but of course I'm still relishing it.
But if Garfinkel had been successful at actually fielding a quality football team, there would be less backlash against him. I went through the Twitter mentions, and it's mostly angry Dolphins fans. It's basically me in 2016 with anything Mike D said. I would find a way to frame it in a way to make him look the worst.
Yeah, I mean, the Dolphins, you know, when they hired Garfin a couple years ago, I was saying how they are the team furthest away from winning the Super Bowl. And I think everyone laughed. I was like, oh, the Browns. I was like, no, everyone knows the Browns are bad. Like, the Dolphins, they don't realize that they're, like, below average. And they're going to keep going forward with the 76-win plan. And then 3 years from now, they'll bottom out. And then they'll start their rebuild. And that's literally what's happened. So they're closer now, maybe. But I think they'd be better off without them. But yeah, I definitely enjoyed watching him have to squirm publicly. Just always a lot of fun for me.
I went back and listened to that's where the Walter Weichel quote was from, actually, the Whistler quote. I went back and listened to the entire 23-minute Tom Garfinkel Rain Man recording that surfaced today. And I don't – Tom Garfinkel was actually much worse than Eric Grubner was in his recordings. It was difficult to listen to, and like – I've defended Garfinkel, but and as you said on Twitter today, you've talked about the Rain Man incident quite a bit. The thing that shocked me was the level of just blind defense from Padres Twitter luminaries in defending Tom Garfinkel to the death. Like, and I kind of missed this at the time. I don't think I was totally in on what was going on at the time, but like. Was that weird to you?
No, I think that was part of his persona. Like, I think...
Like, in the quote, he talked about the trust tree in his, like, discussion with fans. Like, it was... Yeah. It came off very odd to me, listening to it.
I don't mean to play psychiatrist, but he definitely exhibits some psychopathic tendencies. Like to really control the way everyone thinks about him. And around him, to the point that he, you know, will lie and falsify a bunch of information to your face, and that was what really made me hate him. Like, he was nice enough to respond to my email and invite me into his office, but it was when he was falsifying things in front of me, when I had literally what he had said in quotes, printed out in front of me. You know, that was the point when I realized that this guy's really just a lackey. He's just like he's just doing whatever he needs to do to
keep,
you know, achieve that goal. And I think his goal is just to
keep the paycheck
coming. To earn money and to think that he's doing something to win a sports championship. Because, like, certainly the way he conducted himself in San Diego, he wanted to be a part of the decision making. And he's done that in Miami as well, being a part of all of their GM searches and you know, in the draft green room, et cetera. So...
What
it does not surprise me that a bunch of Padres fans fell for him, because, you know, his persona was to control the way you thought, and you know, that's who he is.
Well,
I'm not surprised.
I've said as a customer he was excellent. Like the product he offered, the value proposition he offered was excellent to customers.
I don't think it was. Like, I never went. So, like,
well,
to me,
you had your dumb non-existent. You had a dumb boycott.
It wasn't – no, the thing is, you have to remember, the boycott didn't start as, like, a boycott. The boycott started as me being, like, just don't feel like going to games. Like, why would I pay that much money to go watch garbage that's obviously not good, not going anywhere, not making any major commitments? Like why would I do – like, there's no value in it. And then after I had not gone for a while, I realized I just shouldn't go for this reason. It wasn't like I woke up one day, I was like, fuck it, not going to Padres games anymore. There wasn't, like, that abrupt sort of – like, the beginning was just – you know, the trickle off of, no, don't think I'm going to pay $23 and drive down there to, you know, go to a food court and watch, I don't know, Brooks Conrad play. Like, that's just not what I want to do today.
So why did everyone defend him? Like, here's a quote from a prominent tweeter and podcaster. Good luck getting Tom Garfinkel to speak candidly ever again. Whoever released that, you're a punk. Come forward, receive your prize. So, like, why was there this just vehement defense of a team president? Like, was it the free goodies he was giving out? Like, I don't know. I miss this phase.
I think some of it was, I don't know. I think when you're given personal attention from someone who seems to be in an authoritative position, maybe it makes you feel good about yourself. And I don't know. He gave off an aura of authenticity, but, you know, over time it became very apparent to me that it was actually quite inauthentic. But he was very good at being persuasive. And like I said, he would tell you whatever he thought you wanted to hear is what he told you. And in that Rain Man interview, the reason it was sent to me was not for that quote. It was sent to me because, you know, it was just after the brawl and, you know, here he's talking to fans and basically blaming Zach Greinke. Right. That was what the guy who sent it to me thought it was about.
Well, there was actually a point. And there was a point where he was like, this stays within the trust tree or the nest. But but let me tell you, then he like whispers into the microphone, I believe he threw it on purpose. Like that's, I think that's the authenticity that people responded to, right?
Well, and the, you know, the thing is about this too, is that the statistics that he actually quotes to the group of people there, like about how frequently Greinke throws a pitch in that location and in that count, were actually wrong. They weren't real statistics. So he had basically invented statistics to back his, I don't know, opinion, which he probably delivered with a very authentic sounding, like you said, tap on the mic and whisper, I think you threw at him sort of thing. But when Jeff Passan actually published the article about it, he actually fact-checked those stats and found that they were incorrect. So basically Garfinkel was lying to all the people in the, quote, trust tree while trying to get them to believe that they were somehow being entrusted with really valuable secret information about why Zach Greinke and threw at the Padres, you know? But when I got the audio and I listened to it and I heard the Rain Man thing, I cannot tell you how freaking happy I was. Like, I just couldn't believe that he would say that, because obviously very distasteful. And I knew exactly who would want to publish it. And like, so I sent it out, sent the audio to him, and about, you know, 30 minutes later, I got it'll be on the cover tomorrow. And like, that was one of the, I definitely opened a bottle of something that night. I can't remember what, but it was a great day. But I'm still waiting for my prize from Brady Phelps. I would love the prize.
It was a Coors Light that you opened.
It was not a Coors Light that I opened. Definitely not.
It's just like an interesting phase of Padres history that I wish I'd paid more attention to right in the beginning.
The thing that always drove me crazy too about him was like, you know, they never negotiated with Adrian Gonzalez to sign him to an extension. And then he sent this letter out to all Padres fans saying how they couldn't afford him and that it was about the, you know, the name on the front of the jersey. And to me, I always took that, okay, like, and this is kind of what I did in the documentary where I took his words and then kind of threw them back in his face. But to me, it was always about the name on the front of the jersey. I totally agree. And so I don't give any shits about you. You're in the front office. Like, I don't care that if you work for the Padres or not. It's about the Padres. Like, that's – and it's so funny to me that there was this cult of personality about a front office executive but not the players, even though the front office executive was using a line of reasoning that you should have also applied to him. I don't know. It was a really weird era. And the other thing about why there was such a big cult was that, you know, Twitter didn't exist at the time, not at the beginning at least. And Gaslamp Ball was where all the discussion took place. And, you know, they had a great interactive comment section. But the person who ran Gaslamp Ball was, you know, his brother-in-law was Brooks Conrad. And, you know, the Padres obviously signed Brooks Conrad. And then he always would refer to Tom Garfinkel as his mentor and was kind of taken under his wing and had, like, personal conversations with him. And so the main outlet that you would go to discuss Padres games live was completely infiltrated by, you know, that. And so there was just like a tremendous bias in that direction. And if you're exposed to it enough, you're going to believe it. So that, and, you know, I don't fault people for that, but I saw through it very clearly. You know, most people didn't get the opportunity that I had to go meet with him in person, but, you know, having had that opportunity and having had him lie to my face. And I actually went into that opportunity very optimistically. Like, like, hey, I'm going to go in there with all these quotes and, you know, ideas on how to improve things. And it's going to be a fruitful discussion based on my limited conversations with him. And then realize that he was just lying directly to my face, like very clearly. You can always kind of tell when someone's lying to your face.
Yeah.
Or at least I'm perceptive enough to pick that up a reasonable amount of the time. But that was when things really turned and I was like, you know what I think my goal is? I think my goal is to get you fired. Like, that is now my goal. I'm definitely relishing in him struggling in Miami a whole bunch.
I guess I have one last question to close out the show. So, sure. So Brady Phelps in the tweet that I quoted said, good luck getting Tom Garfinkel to speak candidly ever again. Do you think that the Rain Man episode, which blew up, which was like a lead story on every major sports site, do you think that this incident led to the control the message, own the media, like, environment that we have now under, you know, the dictator Wayne Partello? Like, do you think that this planted the seed for that? And do you think Brady Phelps was right in a way in that this incident led to just the Padres front office turtling and hiding from ever speaking candidly on anything?
I don't know. Like, I don't think Garfinkel, like, again, I'm not sure if him talking like that to fans was like a baseball strategy. I think it was like a him personal strategy. Like, how can he endear himself to fans for his own purposes? Like, I think that was his goal. And now the keep everything in house, I feel like, is actually a baseball strategy. Like, I don't think it's about Grubner, or I don't think it was about necessarily D. I think that was just, let's just limit negative I mean, they're not very good at it, but let's just limit it negative press as much as we can. Right? I think, you know, I think that's more of it. I don't know. I don't think it necessarily contributed, you know, positively or negatively. And it's not like Tom Garfinkel stopped talking to fans. Like, he still had some of these meetings. He still did things after that. I just think that he was much more maybe guarded in what he said at the time going forward.
Well, that was a theory here,
which is
right?
good because he. I mean, that's a good thing. Like, you don't want someone going out there and making up, inventing Zach Greinke statistics and lying to their fan base and then disparaging, you know, and conflating autism with other, you know, mental health issues and laughing about it. Like, those are bad qualities that you don't want someone doing that. So the fact that he learned that lesson and now his son, when he gets older, will, you know, will presumably hear that audio and hear his father, you know, crying and apologizing on the radio. It'll be a good life lesson for him. So I'm happy for them because of that. Like, and I think it's good. Like, I don't have no regrets over it at all. Like, obviously there was some Schadenfreude for me. Certainly, even today, I'm like kind of laughing about it, but like, I think it was good for that to happen. Like, I don't think that's bad.
Have you,
like, when someone's a lying piece of shit to their fan base, they should get in trouble for it.
Have you tweeted Tom Garfinkel and offered to review his tweets with him and maybe offer some insight, kind of like what you offered to Uncle Ted Leitner?
No, but I will say that occasionally I do go look at his mentions. Just to like all of the ones that are super mad. I do that. It is a personal thing with him because after, like, he got wind that the documentary was about to be aired. Because, like, I was posting it, you know, on Sign On San Diego forums at the time. And people met up and, like, listened to it. And, you know, I think most people on the website thought it was going to suck ass. And I was like, I think it's almost done. And I met with Woe Doctor at Pete Support. And he, you know, just responded to the forum, you guys, it's good. The next day I contacted Scott Miller and, Jeff Passan, and they both responded super quick. Scott Miller was just quicker. And, somehow I think Garf got wind of it was coming either through monitoring the boards or maybe someone at CBS tipped him off or something. And he actually went through a slander and libel campaign against me to Scott Miller and two other people at CBS saying, here's why you should not air this documentary. He hadn't seen the content obviously or anything. But so it is personal with him. So anytime someone on Twitter is like, you're a piece of shit, they need to fire you. Like, the Dolphins have been shit ever since you've been here. No one fucking cares about the color of the seats. Just put a winning product out there. Like, hire a better GM. I like that tweet, like, every fucking time. It's awesome. Like, it really is. I'm sure he has me muted. But
I think you should probably grab some representative examples of his tweets that he could truly use to improve.
He doesn't tweet. Like, he doesn't tweet very often. He's very soft-spoken on Twitter, which is a surprise given how he controlled things in San Diego. But like I said, I think he's learned from his mistakes potentially a little bit. And that's why I said, like, as much as I'm enjoying him getting shit, like, I actually don't super disagree with him. Like, I just kind of don't. Also, if my boss, like, contributed to a political person that I don't agree with, so say, I don't know, communist person, like, I don't know, communist party member, and then I was asked publicly about it, like, I'm not going to slam my boss publicly, you know, like, I get it. So, I don't know, I think a little bit of the pushback against him is a little unfair, but I still love it.
Meanwhile, our owner, Uncle Ron, donated a large sum of money to the Jeb Bush campaign in the last election, which is like
I forgot about that.
Just peak Padres, right? That they
the most milquetoast candidate that
they chose, the most boring, least likely to win the nomination candidate to commit thousands of dollars to Jeb exclamation point.
Yeah,
at least Stephen Ross backs someone that's won something, right?
That's true. That is true.
Ugh,
barely. But yeah.
Also, Ron Fowler also committed $15,000 to the Mitt Romney campaign as well. So he's got a pretty poor,
very milquetoast,
pretty
record.
Poor record at picking winners.
Figure out who he donates to this time around and hedge. Yes. You know, that's the bet. All right. Well,
this has been a real mega episode.
Yeah, hour and a half. Yeah. Well, until next time, go Padres.
Go Padres.